You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 27th, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Hello, all.
And special guest, Daniel Loxton.
Hi, everybody.
Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Where did you come from?
Get in here.
Like a magic elf. Poof.
Well, Daniel is our second guest rogue. People seem to respond well to the whole idea. They like Richard Saunders, who was on the show a couple of weeks ago. And actually, we moved you up in the rotation a little bit, Daniel, to talk to us about your new book, Evolution. But before we get to that, Evan's going to tell us about This Week in Skepticism.
January 27, 1921, when Albert Einstein suggested the possibility of measuring the universe, which startled the audience of the Prussian Academy of Sciences in Berlin with his address Geometry and Expansion.
I picture a dozen monocles falling out of eyes.
And a bunch of people saying, Ach du liebe!
Great visual.
Applying certain results of the relativity theory, he came to the conclusion that if real velocities of stars, as could be measured, were less than the calculated velocities, then it would prove that real gravitation's great distances were smaller than the gravitational distances demanded by the law of Newton.
Could you repeat that last part?
Yes, law of Newton.
Thank you. Okay, good.
No problem.
It's crystal clear now.
So, Daniel, you work for Skeptic Magazine, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I work for Skeptic, where I do the junior skeptic section of Skeptic Magazine, which is a 10-page bound-in thing at the end for kids.
You're the editor and illustrator of that, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I write and illustrate most issues. Occasionally, I bring in a guest writer and edit that, but usually it's just me.
And you've just come out with a book called Evolution, How We and All Living Things Came to Be, which you both wrote and illustrated. Is this your first book?
It's my first English language book. We rolled out a Portuguese language one, only available in the country of Portugal last year, just in time for the Darwin 2009 celebrations. It was also on the topic of evolution and also based on junior skeptic material.
You know, Portuguese?
No, not a word. I actually can't pronounce the name of my first book.
Interesting choice.
That's great. But that gets to be troublesome, doesn't it?
Why did you decide on Portuguese then?
It wasn't my decision. We were shopping around a book project based on the Junior Skeptic articles about evolution, and this large philanthropic organization called the Gulbenkian Foundation in Portugal contacted us, wondering if they could license the Junior Skeptic story. And at that time, I was just right in the middle of talking to Kids Can Press, the publisher for the English language one. And what ensued was a very complex three-way negotiation. But we managed to get both projects licensed at the same time.
Oh, super.
So you were kind enough to send me a review copy of the book, and I like it. It's very pretty.
Oh, I'm glad it made it out to you.
I did. And it's clearly aimed at kids. What would you say the age range is the sweet spot for the book that you were aiming for?
My publisher is positioning it for ages 8 to 13. I think that's probably about right. It's a little bit, for anyone who's familiar with Junior Skeptic, it's pitched a little bit younger than Junior Skeptic. Like Junior Skeptic, it has that the kind of stealth adult quality about it as well. So that,
yeah.
It is, I think, pleasant enough reading for an older reader, kids my age, say.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually a really nice primer on evolution. I'm sure that probably 90% of the population isn't familiar with a lot of this information.
Well, it seems that 50% of the population thinks dinosaurs and humans lived at the same time. So.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
it's in all the cartoons. Why wouldn't they think that?
Yeah. Ergo.
They didn't?
50%, folks.
But I saw it on TV.
20% of this podcast thinks so.
I love the cover. Is that it shows a bird-like dinosaur going after like a dragonfly. Is that like an Archaeopteryx or?
Yeah, that was what we were aiming for, Archaeopteryx.
Where did that image come from?
Oh, well, I went back in time with my camera. That's how I got that.
did you make that? Did you?
Yeah.
Commitment.
Holy crap, dude. That rocks.
This one is made by myself and Jim Smith, who works with me on Junior Skeptic.
Wow.
Well, let's get on with some news items. Rebecca, you're going to tell us about dowsing for bombs.
Oh, am I?
Are you going to say it's a bad idea?
If you choose.
Is that like bobbing for apples?
I just don't like getting bossed around, that's all.
Do it.
Yes, sir. So, my new home country has been making waves this week because a company here has been selling for the past several years, actually, dowsing devices. They've been selling them not like when most people, I think, in our audience think of dowsing. They think of farmers dowsing for water or for oil, things like that. But these dowsing devices were actually meant to find bombs and other explosive materials, which makes it like when you're dowsing for water or oil or gold, that we can pass off as a hobby for old bored men. But in this case, it becomes something much more dangerous.
So what's the difference between the ones for water and the ones for bombs?
Well, the ones for water don't kill people. That's the main difference. The thing is, neither works. Both operate on the ideomotor effect, which is basically the idea where if you, let's say you hold a pendulum in your hand, it could move left to right or up to down without you realizing that you're making it move. It's a, let's say, a subconscious or unconscious movement on your part that causes something to move. So the same thing goes for, say, an Ouija board. You don't realize that you're making it move, and it seems very magical. Well, the same goes for dowsing rods. And so in this case, it's a company that is selling dowsing rods for the purpose of selling to the military in Iraq, which is pretty much the worst place you want to have a pseudoscientific device meant to detect explosives. This is a machine, and I use that in the loosest term possible, which is to say not a machine. It's basically a piece like a plastic box with an antenna coming out of it. And there's actually nothing in the box.
No, that again?
Yeah, yeah. It's that again.
Oh.
Randy actually talked about this ages ago, years ago. He offered this company the chance to partake in the $1 million challenge, and obviously they never responded. Recently, the mainstream media has caught on. Last November, there was a big New York Times story on this company. Finally, there was a major investigation into the company, and just this past week, the president of the company has been arrested on charges of fraud, which is really fantastic news because it's the first step to getting these devices pulled out of Iraq. In the time that they've been in Iraq, supposedly detecting bombs, literally hundreds of people have died from bombs that have made it past these detectors. So, I mean, it's a serious problem. If there were a working detector at these checkpoints, those bombs would not have made it through, and those hundreds of people might still be alive. So the company is ATSC, and Jim McCormick is the name of the managing director. McCormick literally has, you know, hundreds of lives on his hands right now. But he doesn't really seem to care. He's defending his BS product and claiming that it works by using the body's static electricity and other pseudoscience explanations. There's a news magazine TV show here called Newsnight, and they looked into it. They took the device, or actually a very similar device, and took it apart and found nothing inside. And then what McCormick has are these cards that are supposedly they're attuned to different substances. So you stick a card in the device depending upon what you want to detect. If you want to detect a torpedo. You would stick the torpedo card in, for instance. So they did get their hands on a set of these cards. They took them to a computer expert, a computer engineer, who peeled them apart and found that inside was not any kind of memory chip, any kind of computer chip. It was merely one of those security tags that they put, for instance, on DVDs at Sam Goody. So, you know, it'll set off the alarms when you go out the door.
So that was the working part? That was it?
That was the only piece of, yeah, wiring that was inside this car.
I'd say that qualifies as fraud.
Yeah. The computer engineer said, no, there's absolutely no way you could put any information on this card. Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's a quantum thing.
Right. I'm sure it is.
Quantum is
must be.
Entanglement, spooky action at a distance, you know, all that good stuff.
Quantum is probably the one buzzword that this guy hasn't tried to use. So it's not looking good for him, but these devices are still being used in Iraq, you know, as we speak, which is tragic because people are still putting their faith in these things, which means bombs are still getting past these things. This guy really, and the guy, Jim McCormick, I should also mention, is out on bail. So, I mean, it's not done yet by any stretch of the imagination, but it's the first big step in hopefully putting him away for good.
You know, what an unbelievably evil scam, right? It's one thing to, like, read somebody's palm and give them some BS or whatever, but you're selling bomb detectors to the military.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like the callousness of that is pretty extreme.
I mean, it's difficult for me to imagine a way that Jim McCormick could be somehow delusional to the point where, like, he might actually believe that this works. It's literally an empty plastic box with, you know, a security tag shoved in it. There's no way you could think that that works.
On the other hand, it's not surprising that the operators think it works. The operators always think that dowsing rods work. It's really a persuasive effect.
It's very convincing.
You know, apart from the callousness of this, two things really stood out for me about this story. One is that none of these claims ever go away. You know, they just always surge back. Just when they seem totally quaint and passe, they surge back and they kill somebody. And the other thing is that it took a dedicated professional skeptic to set the ball rolling to try and put a stop to this.
Mm-hmm. It took many, actually, because not only did Randy come out publicly against these back, I think it was October 2008, but recently, after the New York Times article, Bruce Hood, who I think we've had on the show before, he wrote the book Super Sense. He's a very sweet guy here in England. He contacted the company and asked if he could test the device. Or actually, I should say, he wrote a blog post about the company. Jim McCormick commented on the blog post and said, oh yeah, come on out and test it. You'll see it works. And so he agreed, and Newsnight wanted to come along with him. And that's how they got into the whole thing. And I think that's one of the big things that got this ball rolling as well. So I think that the skeptic blogosphere did a really fantastic job of keeping after this company until the mainstream media caught on. I think we can count this one as a win for skeptics.
It reminds me of one of the main functions for having a skeptics movement and people who do skepticism in a dedicated way is just being a memory bank for these kinds of weird claims. Like, I remember Randy talking about the Quadro tracker back in the early 1990s. And at that time, it was a dowsing rod. It already seemed kind of quaint. But, it's really weird. Like, the Quadro golf ball finder, Junior Skeptic busted that way back in 98, I think.
Yeah, so this thing keeps popping up. This is the Quadro tracker. You're absolutely right. And we discussed similar devices where, you know, people sell essentially what is a gadgetry dowsing device for finding lost people, for hunting treasure, looking for contraband or drugs. The Quadro, I think that was the one, right, that Randy investigated, where rather than some kind of electronic chip, the guy was like Xeroxing a picture of the thing you were looking for. Like he would Xerox a picture of a bullet and put it in there. Now it will find bullets, which is like the equivalent of like the cartoon characters like drawing a rabbit on their detector, like hand drawing it on, and then it will detect rabbits, you know?
It could work.
Yeah. Did you guys hear this guy's response when, like, the doubts were first being raised? And he's like, oh, yeah, I could see why people might be suspicious because it looks kind of simple. So the next version, we're going to put blinking lights on it.
Blinking lights. Wait, Steve, wait. He said that and he, like, believed it?
Yes.
Yes,
we added 50% more novelty things.
Was that
50% more distracting?
Wait, I have to clarify this. Did he say that to like a consumer or someone asking him whether or not
it works? To the press.
So this guy legitimately thought that blinking lights added to its effectiveness?
No, added to its appeal, its visual appeal.
Yeah.
It's called the Christmas tree effect.
Okay, that's why I was clarifying.
The actual quote in the New York Times article back in November 2009 was, "One of the problems we have is that the machine does look primitive. We are working on a new model that has flashing lights."
You know, that actually would be a huge step forward because suddenly it would become a working machine of some sort. It would be a light blinking machine.
Right. It would actually be doing something.
Yeah.
So what happens? The next model like emits a pleasant scent or something? Is that the next upgrade?
It buzzes.
It's got one of those Christmas tree car fresheners inside of it.
But seriously, law enforcement agencies, the military, the FBI, they keep getting taken in by these dowsing rods. What is it? You know, you can't detect stuff with magic. It's just these little black box devices that says, it tunes in on the frequency. As soon as you hear people saying that, anything like that, it's a scam. Crack one of those things open before you spend taxpayer money investing in these kind of dowsing scams. It's unbelievable that this keeps happening.
You would think that there's some type of protocol for anything to get through like that, right? especially like, okay, I know this sounds ridiculous, but especially bomb detecting devices.
Yeah.
Okay, I can understand if like, you know, they didn't check out like clothing or, you know, didn't do enough research on how long the boots would wear out or whatever, but this is something that saves
it's
lives.
It's mission critical for life saving. Yeah.
Well, but I mean, once you get this new fancy gadget, wouldn't you just do a little test, a little black and white, very easy test between a bomb and not a bomb, just to see it work?
Bomb.
I mean, wouldn't you
not
just
bomb.
Do that?
I can picture the form on the clipboard with just two big boxes to check. Bomb, not bomb.
This is obviously a catastrophic failure of due diligence. And whenever these things are deployed, heads should roll. Somebody should really lose their job because other people are losing their lives. On the other hand, you know, what we have is a very specialized, you know, set of knowledge that, you know, the guys doing military procurement may not have. So I'm somewhat sympathetic that they get taken in by scam artists. It's the kind of perfect storm of a credulous media, credulous government, believers throughout the population, and then scam artists taking advantage of it. That's what really leads to these catastrophes.
Right. I agree, but I also think it requires a profound lapse of just common sense.
Yeah, agreed. You know, agreed.
Well, let's move on. Evan, you're going to tell us about alien life right here on Earth.
Yes, just look around you, for it is everywhere. Well, they're going to be talking about that this week, today I think, in fact, at the Royal Society, in which people from all over the planet are going to be gathering, representatives from NASA, the European Space Agency, UN Office for Outer Space Affairs, people from SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence program, will be there. And they're going to be talking about alien life and how do we detect it and every possible way of detecting it. One professor in particular, Paul Davies, a physicist at Arizona University, will be talking about looking for alien life here on Earth. He believes that, you know, projects such as SETI can really only take us so far, and it's actually kind of a narrow sort of approach to looking for those signals. Basically, somebody has to be out there looking to contact Earth specifically in order for us to be able to detect that. And the chances of that are very, very, very slim. He thinks there's a better chance that we should start looking here on Earth for things. And what exactly does he mean by that? I mean, is he talking about looking at, you know, videotape of gray aliens peeking through windows and, you know, UFOs and other things? No. No, what he's suggesting is that we need to be looking for things such as, you know, microbes, extremophiles, you know, and living in very hostile environments under deep pressure and extreme heat conditions. And these might be the keys to understanding how, you know, effectively life or lives arose on Earth, which is something we talk about regularly on the show. You know, it comes up in conversation, like what would alien life, you know, look like? What are the requirements for alien life? How we go about looking for it.
So yeah, we have talked about this topic before, and the headlines, of course, were deceptive.
Yeah,
he's not talking about aliens, meaning life that evolved off the Earth or somewhere else. He's talking about the evolution, the separate origin and evolution of life on Earth, other than the life that we know.
Right.
So there's alien to our biology,
from, and then there are supposedly other sets of life that do not share the same origins.
It's possible. Yeah, right. It's possible that life was seeded or arose multiple times in the early history of the Earth. One of those branches proliferated into all the life that we now recognize. But he's saying it's not impossible that still existing on the fringes, you know, in the extremes, there may be the descendants of completely separate origins or seedings from billions of years ago, and they would have a completely quote-unquote alien biology. They might be here right under our noses. We just have to look for them, which is an interesting hypothesis. Of course, that's all it is at this point in time.
It's super neat. I don't think they should position it in opposition to SETI or to other kinds of exobiology projects. It's just neat in itself. Like, wouldn't that be the coolest?
Yeah, it would be cool. And you're right. It has nothing to do with exobiology. It's actually a false comparison there.
Well, I don't know about that, Steve. I think there's some comparisons to exobiology in that it's a completely different type of biology
that's just true.
Happened to arise on an Earth class, you know, a planet like Earth with our temperature range and pressures and all that. So it would show us that, yeah, this is a second data point for life.
It's true, but I just think juxtaposing it against SETI makes no sense.
Yeah.
It's in, you know, the kind of searching for microbes type of exobiology, the fieldwork for that is the same as searching for this kind of shadow biosphere denizens, going to extreme environments and deep down into the Earth's crust and things like that.
Yeah, one quote from an article I've read was that less than 1% of all the world's bacteria have been comprehensively studied. Wow, I didn't think it was quite that bad, but less than 1%, that's amazing, especially considering, you know, how diversified their, you know, bacteria's metabolisms are, and especially the extremophiles, which are just probably the most ancient form of life. They've been around so long. They're the ones that live, you know, down in the deep sea vents under incredible temperatures and pressures. I mean, just finding different extremophiles, I think, would be worthwhile just to see what, you know, the range of biology that's even possible, even if there's only one origin on Earth.
I'm really surprised to hear that, Bob. I mean, that means that out of all the bacteria that we've found and have actually studied, that our scientists just don't have time to get to such an enormous amount that they know we're there. Like they can see them as something they haven't identified and just don't have the time.
So I guess a lot of it's not just not having the time, but they're just, you know, incredibly inaccessible.
It's also time and resources. I mean, you only have so much lab time.
Yeah, that too. That's part of it too.
It's not a trivial thing to crack under the hood and really look at the biochemistry of every single species. Sometimes you're hard to know even if you have a new species of bacteria.
Yeah, the taxonomy of bacteria is really bizarre.
Still a huge biological frontier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, bacteria living off of radiation, radioactive materials.
There's bacteria that you could shatter its DNA with radiation, and the DNA built itself back together. Like, hello. I mean, talk about an extremophile.
My favorite will always be the water bears. I think we talked about like ages ago.
Yeah, yeah.
They found that they could be like floating around in space for a while.
Yeah, they're called tardigrades, but they're not bacterial.
They're called water bears.
Well, all right, yeah, they're called, but another name is tardigrades.
I call them space unicorns.
But they're not bacterial though. But they are very, very interesting.
So they're also called moss piglets.
They're called mardi gras.
Tardigrades.
Davies describes a really neat way of looking for these kinds of shadow life forms. He says, look, you know, just in the laboratory, I get a whole bunch of bacteria and just start turning up the parameters until all known forms of life will be wiped out and just see if there's anything left.
And, awesome.
Yeah.
I love it.
And he describes some discoveries of extremely radiation resistant bacteria, things like that. Yeah. So that was so simple.
That's cool.
That's a cool method. Sorry.
You know, he's going to be, I just need to get in a quick plug.
Sure.
He's going to be on Little Atoms in March. I'm
cool.
going to be interviewing him, I think, with Neil Denny.
Fantastic.
So if anybody has any questions you want to ask him personally,
that should be cool.
So, and just to wrap it up, a few other things they're going to talk about at this conference are people are going to give some presentations ranging from looking at the plausibility of life existing, like an arsenic-based life form, that perhaps is here on Earth. And then they're going to also talk about the latest findings on Mars and how that, those findings equate to our search for extraterrestrial life.
I think Mars is our
planet.
Best hope for exobiology right now. Personally,
what about
maybe Europa?
Europa's
up there too.
So far,
but it'll Mars be so is long before accessible. We know about Europa. Yeah. That's the sad thing.
That's a problem. But it's got everything that you'd need though for some nice juicy bacteria.
Yeah, but Mars is more accessible.
Yeah.
We got to knock on the doors in the neighborhood before we can start traveling to the other cities.
Although it's possible that some of these like spectrographic analyses of Earth-sized planets, exoplanets, may actually pay off before we get anything from our own backyard.
Imagine that. Yeah, because you could read the contents of the atmosphere eventually and really say, whoa, this is the biological in origin.
It would be great, but it would be frustrating too because there's nothing we could do immediately. You know, it would take an enormous amount of money to send something out. I mean, we couldn't. I don't think our technology is
close
to sending something out.
I asked Phil Plait about that one time. I said, you know, do we have the technology right now to send a probe to another nearby star? He said, yeah, maybe if you're willing to throw enough money at it. So,
well, if you want to wait tens of thousands of years, I mean, we've got probes now that will intersect other systems in many, many thousands, if not millions of years.
Thousands of years.
Trick is to make them robust enough that they can still wake up and talk to us once they arrive.
Yeah, but the thing is, at this point in time, they would be overtaken very rapidly by the probes we can send out in 100 years.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
Then they would be overtaken by the probes we can send out 200 years from then.
So then you never need to do it. You just don't do it, and you just keep
looking. That's the classic argument.
Well, when we're talking about tens of thousands of years, just not worth it. You know, you got to wait, get that number down a little bit.
That would be like saying, you know, that Columbus should not have set sail because we should just wait for jet fighters.
No, it's
exactly,
not.
Jay. That's exactly like it.
That's totally what he said.
Thanks for agreeing with me.
Whatever. I'm voting Steve, the president of the Procrastination Society.
Whatever.
Well, I'll vote tomorrow.
Yeah, do it.
But
tomorrow.
You got my point.
I'll do it tomorrow.
Bob, tell the story of feathered dinosaurs just keeps getting more and more interesting.
It really does. Do you guys remember the good old days when dinosaurs were like any color, as long as that color was a shade of gray or green, maybe?
Sure.
I had a glow-in-the-dark red triceratops.
Really? Red? Interesting.
I've heard of a purple dinosaur, but he's kind of a jerk.
I love you. So annoying. I'm glad those days when that's on my TV are long gone. But nowadays, you see dinosaurs represented in lots of different colors and patterns. There are still scientists that think dinosaurs were primarily shades of gray or green, just like modern mammals like the elephants or the rhinos. But I think most often those scientists will think that there's no reason why they dinosaurs weren't as colorful as modern day animals, especially lizards and birds and snakes. The reason for the color then would be, right, it would be just as important as it is now to threaten your enemies, for camouflage, to attract mates, and species recognition. There's no reason why I don't think there were some extravagant colors for dinosaurs millions of years ago. But the problem has always been determining what those colors are, right? The most we've been able to do is really take an educated guess. Do you guys remember when the first dinosaur skin impressions were found in fossils. I remember that. I think, was that in the 70s or the 80s? They found these little bumps, these little projections that were like pebbly or scaly projections. They called tubercles, I think that's how it's pronounced. But the pigment that produces the color on that skin, though, doesn't fossilize. So a lot of people think that we're never going to know what color dinosaur skin was. But that doesn't mean that we'll never know if they were colorful, because in fact now we've got a dinosaur that we know precisely what the color was. The dinosaur is Cynosauropteryx from 125 million years ago. Scientists have determined that it was most likely ginger colored, apparently.
Yay!
yeah, sorry.
as the resident ginger here, I have to say that.
But this isn't because of the skin pigment. It's because the feather structures that were fossilized. These scientists were from China and the UK, of course, China, because apparently that's where all the feathered dinosaur fossils are, in China. They announced recently on the Nature website that this Cynosauropteryx had ginger feather, like a mohawk, kind of extending from its head down its back into the base of its striped tail. Now, I want to mention, though, that this works. A lot of times we don't credit the people that really came up with some of these ideas. This work was actually inspired by fossil bird feathers by Jacob Vinther, who's a graduate student at Yale. He and his colleagues really came up with this technique.
Yeah, I mean, we interviewed Richard Prum, who's working with that team.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So what they did was they examined these fossilized feathers. Now, these feathers weren't just they're not normal fossils, right, Steve? These are like the detail is just incredible. They are just fossilized incredibly well, which is what you really need when you're looking at these fossils with an electron microscope. And they found these structures called melanosomes, which in living animals contain melanin, right? You've all heard of melanin. It colors fur and hair and even your skin. They found these melanosomes in the feathers. And the cool thing about these objects is that their shape determines what color they imparted to whatever object they were part of, the shape and the arrangement. So if they were, like, say, sausage-shaped, they would probably be like a black or a gray color. But if they were more ball-shaped, then it would be like a ginger or maybe a russet shade. So that's what they found. They found these ball-shaped melanosomes inside these feather fossils. The professor, Professor Benton from the University of Bristol, in the UK, he said that this is the first time anyone has ever had evidence of original color of feathers in dinosaurs. So I thought this was a pretty cool development. But what's the significance? You know, what does this mean? That, okay, now the dinosaur encyclopedia will be more accurate for this one species. But it's not. It's beyond that. First off, it supports the theory that birds evolved from theropod dinosaurs. Not that the theory needed a hell of a lot more support, but it's good to know that it's a new discovery supports it. Secondly, the finding proves that these structures had to be primitive feathers and not something like shredded tissue. There are still a lot of scientists who are saying that, oh, you know, they weren't feathers at all. It was just these, you know, shredded tissue from the animal that just happened to fossilize too. Because they weren't shaped like real feathers. These are like really primitive whisker-like structures it's believed are very primitive feathers. And then finally, that this reveals key information about the evolution of feathers, right? Because these weren't flight feathers. If you've got a mohawk of feathers going down your head and your back, obviously you're not flying or even gliding around. So they think that they might have been used for a display for mates or to threaten enemies or something like that. It probably wasn't for insulation, because if it's just on your back, then it wouldn't be a very good insulator. So that's why I think it's probably more for a display. Now, Steve, I wasn't aware of some of the criticism for this research. I don't know if you came across any of the criticism. But this guy, Vinther from Yale, he said that the sample size was too small to say that this specific dinosaur was this specific color. He thinks that they need to look at a lot more fossils before they can make a definitive statement as to that it has the color. And there's also another guy, Dr. Theogarden Lingam Solier, at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. He says that these researchers should have looked at dinosaurs with no feathers and to look for those melanosomes in their skin.
As a control group.
Yeah, he said in the email, regrettably, I have to say that the study would not pass muster in college science. And I don't know, I think he might have a point there because, Steve, aren't melanosomes, wouldn't they exist in skin as well? I mean, aren't they the structures in skin that has the melanin pigment that gives skin its color?
Yeah, they would be in skin, but they wouldn't be in fossilized bones, for example, right?
Right, but how about in those cases where skin has fossilized? They might be able to find them in there.
You might,
wouldn't
yeah.
they?
But I guess the question is to make sure that these are actually melanosomes, that you see them only in structures that you think are feathers or skin.
Right.
You're not
right.
seeing them in structures which are just other debris or bone or something that shouldn't have melanosomes. So just as a control. Hey, they're being good skeptics, right? This is the meek reader
yeah.
of peer review.
Absolutely.
This is what they're supposed to do, is raise all yeah. the objections, and then only when you deal yeah. with all of these objections do we say, okay, this looks like it's probably true.
So, Bob, what colors are they saying these dinosaurs would have been?
Ginger-colored. Ginger, russet, kind of a...
Did they, like, actually make a picture?
Alternating patterns
yeah.
as well.
Yeah,
white.
They're redheads and they had stripes, yeah.
Yeah. One thing, you know...
Yeah, the tails.
As someone who does paleo art, one thing I like about this is that it generally confirms what paleoartists infer when we look around at existing animals. You'll tend to see... pattern creatures, you'll tend to see auburn colors and umber colors and blacks and whites. You'll rarely see the kind of like fancy blues and reds that I've put on the head of my Archaeopteryx on the cover of the book.
Right.
Dinosaur artists love putting in blues, but I try to avoid it because it's so uncommon in nature. And
is that a survival characteristic?
I don't know why it's uncommon, but it is in existing creatures.
So we're going to very quickly, Jay, we're going to go from dinosaurs to lizards. And this is actually the next story is the next installation in a series of similar stories that we've been telling on our show.
You're not going to believe this, guys. This
yeah.
freaking,
I bet we won't.
This German guy literally yeah. stuffed 44
Hans.
His name is Hans. He stuffed 44 small lizards into his underwear and tried to get it on a plane.
They're, why did he do that?
To sell them.
Yeah, of course. Like, he's smuggling them.
Oh,
yeah.
It could have been for sexual gratification.
Oh, I think he lost a bet.
Do lizards explode when you ignite them?
Yeah, right. So, it's better than putting a bomb in your underwear. That's definitely
true. Did they count
not for the
all
lizards.
Of his lizards?
Yeah, actually.
Yeah, right. They weren't sure. 44 or
45.
Yeah,
right, 44, 40, wait, 43.
These were really small geckos. And basically, he tried to get on, and they busted him when he was getting on the plane.
Yeah. He was getting them out of New Zealand.
Yep.
And they were worth about $2,800 each.
Wow.
You know, all we have to do is bring back one or two of these each, and we could pay for our trip down under.
Yeah.
Street,
or
awesome.
Save on auto insurance.
street value for these kinds of busts gets exaggerated sometimes, but it was obviously worth his effort to stuff lizards down his pants.
Right. Yeah,
but don't geckos like really small crevices and stuff?
So maybe there were more.
Maybe it was a large man. Lots
can
of
we
folds.
Just trivia
what I mean.
Think about the process here. Like, okay, this guy goes out, he poaches these lizards. You know, apparently he had been doing it. They found custom records from customs that he had been doing it almost every other year, every couple of years he'd come, you know, go back and forth. But okay, so where was he? Was he in the bathroom at the airport? Or was he, like, before he got to the airport, and he literally, like, had to finally do the deed? I have to stick these 44 lizards in my pants. Like, what happens? That has to be on video. I have to see this on video.
Seen the movie Midnight Express? I'm sure it was something like that.
I think he had some kind of specialized container, didn't he?
Yeah, he sewed them into two pockets inside his pants, right?
There had to be all sorts of giggling and stuff like that going on, though, when he was, like, adjusting things and...
Remember, the guy with the birds had bird poop on his shoes. That's how we got busted.
Right.
We keep some frogs and lizards and things like that, and if a cricket gets away, that's 12 cents. So you jump after the cricket. And I can just imagine how fast you'd jump if a $2,800 gecko was escaping from your
hands. Right? No
pretty
kidding.
Damn fast.
Yeah.
Now, there are reasons why people should not be illegally transporting and importing animals from environments to...
Yes.
One place to the other.
It's true. You know, we do laugh about it, but people don't do it, you douchebags.
Yeah. There's a couple of very obvious things.
I really do hate people like that.
You get things like frankenfish who, like, you know, devour whole ecosystems.
You know, well, it's like, you know, you contribute to the extinction of the animal that you might be importing. You contribute to the destruction of the environment that this animal might be taking over. I mean, there's so many things that can go wrong. Plus, the individual animal is not having a good time in your pants. I know that you probably
that
think
of.
That, like, oh, everybody has a good time in my pants. No. No, the lizards are not.
A good rule of thumb is that if an animal is really suitable for keeping at home, there will always already be a successful live breeding program that keeps them keeps a robust right. population in the pet trade. So, like, importing live animals is nuts.
Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
So let's play last week's Who's That Noisy, shall we? Shall we? Shall we? Let's. Here we go.
That's correct. No, that's right. But yellow fever vaccine had leukemia yeah. virus in it, and, you know, this is in the days of very crude science. So anyway, I went down and talked to him, and Albert said, well, why are you concerned about it? I said, well, I'll tell you what. I said, I have a feeling in my bones that this virus is different. I don't know why to tell you this, but I've been around biology a long time. I just think this virus may have some long-term effects.
Mm. Okay. I still have no idea.
I have no idea.
I'm just afraid I'm going to get the leukemia virus.
you got to watch out for that. So have you guys ever heard of Dr. Maurice Hilleman?
No.
I don't think so.
Dr. Maurice Hilleman was an American microbiologist who specialized in vaccinology, and he developed over 36 vaccines, which is more than any other scientist in history. Of the 14 vaccines routinely recommended in today's current vaccine schedules, he developed 8 of them. He's credited with saving more lives than any other scientist in the 20th century. And there's a clip of this on YouTube, you know, which part of this interview with Dr. Hilleman, in which, you know, he basically says these things that essentially cancer and AIDS stem from the vaccinations that they made from carried in by monkeys from these experiments that they were doing in 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 70s. I don't know, Steve, do you know anything more about Dr. Hilleman?
I've heard about these accusations. Yeah, I mean, they've, of course, have never been substantiated. And it's just become part of the anti-vaccine conspiracy lore. And so oftentimes there's like elements that have a kernel of truth to them if you dig down, but it doesn't amount to people getting cancer and AIDS from the vaccine, from any vaccine. That is just not true.
Yeah.
Evan, did anyone guess it?
Well, yes. In fact, several people did. However, it was Evil Eye who guessed correctly first that was Dr. Hilleman. So, very good, Evil Eye.
Good job. What do you got for this week, Ev?
All right. So, this week, we have...
money.
Well, you know, something still doesn't add up, you know? You got your classic mystery here.
Yeah, it's right up there with crop circles.
You don't believe in anything. You don't believe in the afterlife?
Life would be easier if I were gullible.
Be careful.
Okay, so you can, you know, if you can identify the voices in that clip, great. If you can tell me where that clip came from, great. Go ahead, give it a guess. Let me know.
Okay, and thanks, Evan.
Yep, no problem.
We're going to do one email this week. This one comes from Mike Lara from London, UK. Do you know him, Rebecca?
Yay, probably.
Okay.
I know a lot of
people. The other day.
And Mike writes... I was having a discussion with a friend over addictions, in particular substance abuse like alcohol. He was arguing that ultimately it is a choice that the addict makes and that it is not a real disease, in quotes, as such. I'm undecided on this issue, being wary of the bullcrap that Alcoholics Anonymous, amongst other organizations, feeds their members in order to turn them into born-again Christians. But at the same time, I don't feel the issue is as simple as that. Since Dr. Novella's specialization is neuroscience, how akin to a real disease is alcoholism and other substance? In your opinion, should other milder addictions, non-chemically driven ones like, say, video game addiction, be also considered addictions, or are they simply choices that the person chooses to make? Is there even a scientific consensus on these issues? Well, this is a very interesting question. First, I'll have to say that I don't think that the word disease is really applicable. I think that a better term would be a disorder, maybe even an illness, but not a disease. the word disease really should be, I think, used only when you're dealing with a very specific pathology. But what we do know about addiction is that it is not simply behavior or personality or choice. It is definitely a brain disorder. We could see differences in the brain, and I'm not just talking about this kind of subtle things. If you become addicted to a substance, it actually changes the biochemistry of your brain in very specific and dramatic ways. There are, in the primitive part of the brain, specifically those parts that deal with the reward system, there are significant and permanent changes, like the nucleus accumbens, for example, seems to be a focal center, and dopamine seems to be the primary neurotransmitter that's involved. So if what do you call something where the biochemistry of your brain is altered through, you know, in this case, exposure to certain chemicals, let's say? What do we call that?
A mutation.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really a fully free choice, because the changes to the brain are, it's that part of your brain almost that's most designed to influence your behavior. And
designed?
Yeah, you know, by evolution.
Ah.
Oh. Evolutionarily.
Can we just record that so that every time any of us says the word design, it just like automatically designed?
I hate the fact that
designed by
they've
Jesus.
Stolen that word from
yeah.
us.
They really have. You can't use it anymore.
Nope. It stinks.
I have quite a lot of experience with severe alcoholism in my close family. And one of my conclusions is that it's kind of naive to divide. And I think this is what you were saying, Steve, but it's naive to divide the whole world up into, you know, fully deterministic and fully free. You know, it's obvious that in the case of substance abuse, first of all, there are many, many different kinds of abusers abusing in different ways. That's one thing. Another is that it obviously does impact someone's volition or reduce someone's volition when they are, as you say, their brains are altered. And you can see this in behavior. You can see people who have a very strong personality type their volition leads them in one way in particular. And after the addiction takes hold, all those things fall away and their volition is directed in a totally different direction.
Yeah, and that's you know codified in specific diagnoses. I mean, and we see that all the time in the medical context. People engage in what we call drug-seeking behavior, where it's really easy to see what they're doing. They're not really making anything like a rational choice. And once you're familiar with the pattern of behavior, the pattern is actually fairly transparent and regular.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that aspect to it. And you're right. I think a lot of this stems from the absolute false dichotomy between free choice and completely involuntary, out of control addiction. Even people at the absolute bottom of their addiction, it's still possible for some people at that point to just to decide that they are going to stop their addictive behavior. And depending on what factors there are in their life at that time, and it's amazingly unpredictable, by the way, they may or may not be able to change their behavior.
Yeah, it's unpredictable, except when looked at from a public health perspective. We can predictably mm-hmm. know that the position that addicts should just pull themselves up, get their life together, make a clean start. It's a naive, insufficient sort of public policy that
it's statistically predictable, but not individually.
Individually,
what I mean is that you have somebody, for example, even you know come into the emergency room or present to medical attention, saying, "All right, I'm ready. I want to quit." You can't really predict which of those people is going to, in fact, quit and which ones are going to go right back to abusing.
Yeah,
you could say X percentage of them will, or you could identify predictive factors for percentages, but you can't do it individually. So we don't know really what combination of factors push people over that magic threshold where they're able to overcome their addiction. But it's also hugely genetically determined in that, you know, we've been able to breed rats that are born addicts. They are born essentially, you know, you expose them to something and they're completely addicted with a single exposure.
Saves time.
We can also breed rats that are immune to addiction, that cannot be addicted. So it's clearly genetically determined as well. And in fact, you know, human beings seem to have the same, maybe not that extreme, but they're along that spectrum from easily addicted to very difficult to addict. And there's every reason to suspect that it's primarily a genetic difference, and just, you know, how the brain is hardwired to deal with these kind of reward systems and the systems that are in place to control our behavior. But, you know, no choice that we make is, or for very few, is 100%, you know, rational free will choice. All the things that we think and choose and feel are the result of a complex set of subconscious processes that are occurring. Again, to make this false dichotomy between making a free will choice and an addiction, I think it misunderstands how the brain works.
To argue that any choice can be completely free, it really seems like a kind of Cartesian dualism. Don't you need a soul for that? If your body is, you know, the seat of the mind, your body has to be involved in all choices.
Yeah. So you're kind of now getting to the philosophical question almost. Yeah. Do we even have free will? Which I think is complicated, and I'm not really sure I want to get. We've had guests on to discuss this very issue before, like from naturalism.org.
It pretty much always comes down to that conclusion. It's complicated.
It's complicated, yeah.
And I agree, like, that was the first thing that popped into my head, Daniel, is that, like, well, none of us are really choosing, but then that's pretty much always what I think. So.
Yeah, I mean, you still make choices. I mean, operationally, make a choice. Yeah. That still happens. But that choice is deterministic. So it depends on how you define free will and what it really means. But also, even though you may be making a choice, we're not conscious of all of the things that go into that choice.
Yeah,
that's a key thing to understand. So here with addiction, you just have this one factor, this one subconscious factor, which becomes overwhelming and which most people most of the time cannot resist. And that becomes, I think, what can reasonably be determined a disorder. But what the social and medical implications of that are go a little bit beyond the science and the philosophy, though, again, they're informed by them. But you also we have to make some value judgments as well. We're going to do one quick name that logical fallacy before we go on. I blogged about this, so I'll let you know. If you read my blog, you've heard this, but I do want to also just have some fun with it on the show. So very quickly, do you guys know who wrote this? Skeptics believe that all vaccines are safe and effective, even if they've never been tested, that all people, all is in all caps, that all people should be vaccinated, even against their will, and that there is no limit to the number of vaccines a person can be safely given. So injecting all children, for example, 900 vaccines all at the same time is believed to be perfectly safe and good for your health.
I believe that perfectly describes the skeptical straw man built by one would-be Shorties Award winner.
Shorties?
Yes, the Twitter Award.
Would be.
Oh, the Twitter Award. That's right.
He did not win.
Would be winner because he tried to win.
Is that Ray Comfort? Who was it?
Mike Adams.
Neil Adams. No.
Oh, that idiot.
Mike Adams. God.
Mike Adams, the health ranger from, what's his website?
Daniel. Natural News. Naturalwaystodie.com.
Daniel, you know about this chucklehead?
I do. He should really have run under the crybaby tantrum category. I think he would have placed better.
Yeah. So very quickly for our listeners who haven't read the story, he was winning in the Shorty Awards, which is a Twitter award under actually just the nominations for them under the health category. But then it was discovered that there was some ballot stuffing going on. People were creating new Twitter accounts just to vote for him. He may have encouraged them to do that, either probably not realizing because he didn't read carefully that it was against the rules. So he was disqualified for doing that. However, completely aside from his disqualification, the skeptical blogosphere, I think, you know, PZ Myers gets the most credit for this given his following, also, you know, directed skeptics to the voting and launched Rachel Dunlop into the first place position with more than like twice as many votes as the number two position.
Excuse me, I would like to take most of the credit for this. I mean, second to Dr. Rachie herself. But I would just like to point out that after I tweeted it, that's when she went ahead. It could have just been, you know, correlation doesn't prove causation, yeah. Blah, blah, blah. But I choose to believe otherwise.
I was just basing that on PZ's, you know, famous history for breaking
internet. No. I was there totally on top of that.
Okay. Well, I said, and the skeptical blogosphere gets
actually not me. That was my friends, my Twitter friends.
Yes.
To be clear, Rachel Dunlop is a prominent Australian skeptic who's been active in the fight against vaccine hysteria.
Yeah, I hope our listeners know her. We've had her on the show before, and she's 10 kinds of awesome.
She's awesome.
She is.
She's
dynamite.
Super awesome.
Dynamite.
And she's a sweetheart. She's a, you know, totally sweet girl. And which makes it all the more heinous that they that this guy and also
Mercola.
Wink Martindale
and Mercola, another natural guru, totally attacked her. Mercola called her like chubby, and they called her a shill for farm. For it's just really horrible because they were whining because they were losing in a stupid internet. You know,
but the good thing is that Mercola's attacks were so vicious that many of his followers literally came out and said,
backlash.
What is wrong with you? I can't believe you're being this mean.
So one of the consequences
that
was that Mike Adams wrote an article about what skeptics believe, and it's a list of ridiculous straw men. That was what I just read, was just one of the straw men. And that's the primary logical fallacy. And it's just what he does is takes the skeptical position and then distorts it beyond all recognition with the very common and simplistic approach most of the time of just making it into a black and white absolute.
Yeah, he loves that.
He loves that. What others, I think Mark Crislip was the first one to specifically put this in writing, have observed is that a lot of the alt-med types really have a very low tolerance for ambiguity and nuance. Things are either all good or all bad. It's, you know, it's completely black or white, simplistic thinking. It's either a drug is either a poison or it's a miracle cure. There's really nothing in between. There's no complexity about risk versus benefit or anything. So you can just see that thinking throughout this logical fallacy. All vaccines are perfectly safe all the time, an unlimited amount to everybody, and we should force it against their will.
You know, Steve,
really?
Part of the mentality, too, is there's no fun in those layers of gray there, right? Like they love the magical thinking, and they also loved it to hate things. You know, they want to put down things simultaneously putting up the things that they support.
Well, this guy has something to sell. So from one point of view, again, this is my opinion, I'm not convinced that he may not believe any of this. This could all just be BS that he does as marketing ploy. Right. But to whatever extent he does believe any of this, it's just really childish thinking. Again, it's this sort of black and white, complete inability to deal with any kind of nuance or complexity to issues that are very complex. So that leads to this ridiculous caricature. And he, you know, there are some people who do think like this, whether he does or not, that do, you know, we get this kind of feedback all the time. It's like, well, actually, this doesn't reflect the skeptical position at all. We think that only vaccines that have been shown to be safe by being tested, those are the ones we think are safe, the ones that have been tested and found to be safe and effective. We don't think there's no limit. He's completely distorting something that Paul Offit wrote, which is about the antigenic load that or exposure, like how many different types of things can the immune system be safely exposed to. And the fact is that vaccines represent an insignificant exposure to the immune system. It's just very targeted against those specific viruses or whatever that you're being vaccinated against. But just kids going through their daily lives are going to be exposed to hundreds of times, you know, the amount of antigens and things that stimulate the immune system. That's what he was referring to. But here's the thing, that even though the vaccine schedule has increased, the number of antigens in those vaccines has decreased. So we're actually getting less, our immune systems are getting less exposure than they were in the vaccine schedule from, say, 20 years ago.
So they're more efficient.
Yeah, it's more efficient. It's all irrelevant because we're swimming in antigens. This is an insignificant addition to that. Plus, if anything, in modern life, we're getting too little exposure. Our immune systems are too protected and
right.
not getting enough of a workout. Our immune systems need to be challenged even more. So Mike Adams managed to get every single thing wrong in his statement.
Batting 1,000.
You know, he's one of those guys, when I read what he writes, his manner of writing, it just feels like he's yelling everything.
Yeah.
You know, he's not writing in Uber caps or anything, but he's ranting.
Might as well be all caps, right?
Yeah.
Well, he throws some of caps in there for emphasis.
Yeah.
Now, Rebecca knows what I mean by Uber caps.
Super caps lock.
Yeah.
Super caps lock.
And I don't care.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics, my international panel of skeptics. Daniel, you're in Canada, right?
Yeah, I'm so twice as international.
Yeah, so you got Canada,
sorry.
UK, and
what's
United
it make
States.
Me, 3 times as international?
I challenge my international panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake.
Number one.
Naturalists have discovered that when wasps lay their eggs in figs without reciprocating by fertilizing the tree retaliates by killing the eggs. Item number 2, researchers have discovered that bats and dolphins have the same genetic mutations in the same protein responsible for their echolocation. And item number 3, a new study finds that running barefoot burns 15% more calories than running shod.
Or shoeid.
More calories?
Rebecca, go first.
Oh, man.
See, I'm telling you what to do again.
No.
I demand that you shoot me now.
I can believe that that trees retaliate against wasps by killing their eggs. That seems... It's very Day of the Triffids, but... I can see how that would benefit the tree to evolve in such a way that it would favor wasps that would fertilize it. So that makes sense. Bats and dolphins having the same genetic mutations in the same protein responsible for their echolocation, that also sort of makes sense. I mean, they're both mammals using echolocation. I don't really know. I haven't heard anything about that. Running barefoot burns 15% more calories than running shod. This makes me suspicious, only because I know that there have been several studies recently that have shown that running barefoot is it's better for your joints. For instance, it's not necessarily better for the soles of your feet or your ankle support, but it is supposedly better for your knees and your hips. It's like the more natural way to run. So if anything, I would think that it would be a more efficient way to run. And therefore, I think that that is the fake item. I believe that running barefoot actually burns fewer calories than running shod.
Okay. Daniel, why don't you go next?
Okay. Do you mind if I just say for a long time?
That's what Bob does.
Someone's putting a depressor on your tongue or something. Yeah.
Well, let me see. The fig one, I just off the top of my head, I can't think what the mechanism would be. The dolphin bat one, that's interesting because like, you know, there are these master genes that encode for eyes in like fruit flies and rabbits. So it seems plausible on the surface, although those are not very closely related lineages of mammals. I would guess that neither of them had direct ancestors that had echolocation. The barefoot thing, let me see. If it was very cold, you'd vent a lot of calories. Mind you, that might actually be more efficient when you're running. You have waste heat to get rid of. So just off the top of my head, let's say the dolphin one's false.
Okay, Jay.
Okay, so the wasps laying their eggs in fig trees. I you know, I've been thinking about this since you said it, and I'm trying to figure out like how does the fig tree kill the eggs, and how does it know that the flower wasn't pollinated? And I don't have the answer to those questions, so I can't really – I can't comment on that. I mean, it's I'm sure that it's possible, but I just can't put it together right now. The researchers have discovered that bats and dolphins share the same genetic mutations. That – man, I hope that's true because that's really, really interesting, and it also proves evolution. And then finally, the study shows that, that running barefoot burns 15% more calories than running shod. I don't – I think that one – is the fake.
Okay, Bob?
I basically think that Rebecca just totally nailed it. Let's see. I could see that the selective pressure for the wasps and the fig tree, I could totally see how there would be a really intense selective pressure to do that. I can't think of a mechanism either, but I just don't know enough about the actual process of, you know, where they're laying the eggs and where they would fertilize, and I don't know much about fig trees either, so that doesn't bother me too much. I could see how that could arise over time, so that's not bothering me too much. The dolphins and bats, that's an interesting one, because the same specific genetic mutation in the same protein, that's saying something, because bats and dolphins, man, they split off of a common ancestor quite a while ago, and the fact that they've got the same mutation is pretty interesting. But I mean, just, you know, convergent evolution. They're trying to solve the same problem, and it just probably means that there's a specific way for echolocation to really work, and they just happen to nail it separately. The third one, again, I think Rebecca nailed it. That from my understanding is that barefoot running is actually a little less injury prone than wearing running shoes. It's probably a little bit more efficient. And I would agree that it would probably burn even fewer calories. 15% seems like a lot anyway, even besides all that I just said. So I'm going to say that the running barefoot is fiction.
Okay, Evan.
These naturalists have discovered that when white Anglo-Saxon Protestants lay their eggs, what? Oh, I looked up the definition.
It's not an acronym.
Yeah, they're not in all caps. Yeah, well, there are plenty of examples of symbiosis in nature, are there not? So
yes,
I'm not
correct.
Surprised at all that there would be something to the effect of a tree, quote-unquote, retaliating by killing the eggs. I'm not sure it's not necessarily a... Well, I guess you could consider it kind of a deliberate act.
But does it have a free will?
In a certain context. Well, you know. I mean,
Evan, do you think it's like the Whomping Tree in Harry Potter?
or Treebeard in Lord of the Rings or something, right? But, you know, some sort of chemical reaction might be happening that causes the death of the eggs. So I think that's okay. And, yeah, for me it came down to bats and dolphins with the mutations and the barefoot runners. Those were the two that I'm choosing back and forth between. After hearing the arguments, I must admit I am influenced that the running barefoot one is a little more stinky to me. So I'll say that one's fiction.
So you guys are
Sorry.
Leaving poor Daniel hanging out
well,
there by himself.
I kind of feel bad. Like, you know, I'm like, you know, kind of the last
okay.
one. I'm like, Daniel, got to go.
Well, you all agree.
You all agree that... naturalists have discovered that when wasps lay their eggs in figs without reciprocating by fertilizing the tree retaliates by killing the eggs. You think that's science? And that one is science. And yes, cool. For the reasons that you stated, it makes perfect sense. Actually, figs and wasps are a good example of co-evolution. They evolved a relationship together. The wasps lay their eggs in the figs and reciprocate by fertilizing the fig trees. What the scientists discovered is that what happens is the wasps lay their eggs in the actual fig. And if they don't fertilize the tree will drop the fig onto the ground, killing all the eggs inside, because it will just then rot and it will not be able to sustain the eggs. That's how they do it. That's exactly the kind of thing that selective pressures would create, because there's no advantage to the tree apparently, of hosting the wasp eggs if the wasps aren't doing their bit back for the tree. So that forces compliance. And that kind of thing is very common in nature, actually.
So the tree's saying, no, reach around, I'm going to drop that fig.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, my God.
No. Well, let's go on number two. Researchers have discovered that bats and dolphins have the same genetic mutations in the same protein responsible for their echolocation. Daniel, you didn't buy this one. Everyone else thought this one was science. And this one is science.
Yeah!
But, Daniel, you had the same reaction that I had. This is, yeah, sure, this would be convergent evolution because dolphins and bats certainly do not share a common ancestor with echolocation. And actually, I think the same body of research also showed similar findings with toothed whales. What this suggests is that this is mega convergent evolution. It's not just producing the same basic morphology, but actually the same mutations at a DNA level of, you know, convergent mutations. That's rare, at least as far as what we have discovered. What this led the researchers to hypothesize is that, now also for a little bit more background, the protein is a protein that is responsible for the structure of the hair cells on the inner ear. These are the neurons that have the little hair-like projections that respond to the vibrations in the fluid in the inner ear that hear the sound. And in order to have echolocation, you need hair cells that can vibrate much more quickly. So what the researchers hypothesize is that there must be only a very few ways to achieve that goal of making being able to detect much more frequent vibrations, high frequency vibrations, and therefore this is the only way to for vertebrates who have the basic structures already in place to evolve echolocation. They all had to hit upon the same solution, which I think Daniel, Bob, I think, who actually mentioned that if there must only be a very limited number of ways, so they all hit upon the same way.
Yeah, I did.
Makes it sound like, I mean, it's always hard to make these kind of statements about what is or is not out there, but the researchers made it seem as if this is one of the most extreme examples of convergent evolution that we've discovered, again, down to the mutation level.
That's really neat, but I think what it all comes down to is that it should be a point for me because I'm a guest.
That's right. Well, I mean, I did do some evolution themed items, in honor of our guest, since your book on evolution. But sometimes what happens, Bob learned this the hard way, especially earlier on in the show, that sometimes the more you know, the harder the game is because you get tripped up on, because how surprising this news item is. Right. So if you didn't know how surprising it is, it might not bother you that much and you might gloss over it. I'm actually surprised how much you guys knew about the whole running barefoot thing. So a new study finds that running barefoot burns 15% more calories than running shod is fiction. The real news item is a study came out showing that barefoot running is probably more safe biomechanically than running with shoes. What the researchers were looking at was the way in which the foot strikes the ground when running barefoot versus running wearing shoes. When running with shoes, about 70% of people will strike with the heel, which puts a lot of wear and tear on the heel itself, and also creates a lot of shock through the joints, the knees, and the hips. Whereas most people running barefoot will strike more with the front of the foot and distribute the weight more evenly across the foot as they strike the ground, and therefore it has less of an impact. You guys are also right, those who mentioned this, it's actually running barefoot's a little more efficient, so it's 4% more efficient, not 15% less efficient. So I wanted to make sure that my thing was unequivocally fiction, so that's why I went with something that was the opposite of the truth. So very interesting.
I wonder if they can use that information to design better sneakers.
Yeah.
Or is it a matter of is it the thickness itself that causes the heel to strike? Because it's hard to do away with the thickness because that's, a sneaker's got to have a certain thickness, really.
Yeah, it does seem that minimally shod, just like having a sandal type thing.
Right.
You run more as if you were barefoot. So you just have an extra layer, essentially to replace the calluses that would otherwise be there if you actually did walk around like a hobbit all the time in bare feet, then you could just put a strip of leather on the bottom of your foot, but not the, all the arch support and the ankle support and all the other things that that modern shoes have.
I put it to you guys that running barefoot actually makes you burn a lot less calories, because who the hell is going to run barefoot?
Well, the people who do it say they like
it. In this country, yeah.
They say they enjoy it.
I can't do it here. I mean, the only place I would even consider running barefoot would be like on a football field or something.
A track.
You know?
Well, here's the thing to remember, though. If you're not used to running barefoot, then your muscles are not toned in the different way that you use them when you run barefoot, and your feet don't have the calluses that they would have if you frequently go barefoot. So yeah, you can't go from a life in shoes and then suddenly go jogging marathons barefoot. You would have to slowly transition.
Yeah.
So you have to think about it that way. I think also the bottom line is the jury is still out on whether or not, in terms of injuries and other things, there's really a significant advantage to running barefoot versus running in shoes. I don't think there's really a clear answer there. But it's interesting that there may have been some inadvertent changes to the biomechanics of running with shoes that have some disadvantages. And Bob, you're right, we may be able to compromise to, because, you know, I'm not going to walk around with no shoes on. You know, that's not going to happen. But they may be able to compromise by designing shoes that give you the advantages of shoes without changing the biomechanics and having the disadvantages come along for a ride.
Nano shoes.
Right. And I'll also mention, I don't know if any of you guys have heard this, but Brian Dunning of Skeptoid actually did a recent episode all on this controversy. So if you want to listen to Brian talk about this topic for 10 minutes, you can look at Skeptoid.
I'll run right over there.
So congratulations, guys. Daniel, not a bad first try. Did you make a good effort?
Better luck next time.
You don't have the experience that these other guys have. They have a very good track record against me recently. They're getting too good at this game. Well, Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
I do have a quote. I have a quote. This is a quote from Charles Darwin.
I've heard of him.
Chucky.
Charlie. It appears to me, whether rightly or wrongly, that direct arguments against Christianity and theism produce hardly any effects on the public, and freedom of thought is best promoted by the gradual illumination of men's minds which follows from the advance of science. Michael Shermer quoting Darwin!
Yeah, so actually, I sent that to Jay, but I picked it up from Michael Shermer's blog post on Skeptic Blog today, which I thought, hey, that's a great quote. We'll send that to Jay for the quote of the day, quote of the week.
Great quote. Steve, there's an alternate ending to this quote. We could ask Daniel to yell the name out.
You just want me to yell Charles Darwin?
Well, you could say what I said, or you could say Charles Darwin, and you could do any version of what I do, but it has to be kind of a yell.
Embellish it however you want.
Charles Darwin! Darwin, man.
Wow. I like it. That's the most you've ever not sounded like yourself that I've ever heard.
I know. That sounded like an infomercial guy.
Right?
Billy That's Mays. My backup career.
Well, Daniel, thanks for being a guest rogue on the Skeptic Side. We really enjoyed having you.
Thanks so much for having me. It's awesome.
Daniel, your new book
awesome, Daniel.
Sounds awesome. I can't wait to get a hard copy, and I'm going to expect you to sign it 2 or 3 times.
Yeah, I got a hard copy, but Daniel, you didn't sign it. So when I see you, next time I see you, I'll have to get you to sign it, and I look forward to reading through it with my daughters.
You actually probably got that hardcover, got that hard copy before I got my author copies. That one went straight out from the publisher, but I'll be perfectly happy to sign each and every one of the 5 copies that you're each going to buy. So
okay, great.
what was that last word? I missed that last word there. It was static. Steve, you gotta run up to. You got to run up to Daniel and say, can I have your autograph? Can I have your autograph?
Yeah, we totally got to do that. That would be awesome. We'll do it at TAM. Look, it's Daniel Loxton. Oh, my God. I have his book.
Well, thanks for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Our pleasure.
Always a pleasure. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.